Today we're beginning the final chapter of the book of Acts. So if you go to Romans chapter 1, take a left, and you'll be right there at Acts 28. And be able to share as Paul finally makes it to his destination of Rome. I'm inspired by stories of missionaries. As a boy, I lived vicariously reading about the adventures of David Brainerd, who gave up being a professor at Harvard and went out to be a missionary to the Indians in the frontier. I read about Mary Slessor, the White Queen of the Cannibals, as she went to the headhunters and cannibals in New Guinea, of Amy Carmichael, of Eric Liddell, the Flying Scotsman who won the Olympic gold medals and then went to China and died as a martyr to the Japanese during World War II, of Elizabeth Elliot or Hudson Taylor, and always excited to see them reach a field. You know, you say, okay, boy, they've trained, they've done what they did, they raised support, and off they go, and they reach the people that they want to minister to. Oftentimes, it brought tears to my eyes to read about what happened after that, what went on the field, and their final days. And the way I look at the Apostle Paul is the same way that I look at someone like Adoniram Judson. Adoniram Judson Jr., born in 1788 and died in 1850. His birthday was celebrated this past week. And he's been a hero of mine. He was the first Baptist missionary to foreign lands. If you think about that, that was just in the War of 1812, that era. That's when foreign missions really took up. Before that, people just didn't care. They said, well, if it's God's will for the heathen to hear the gospel, they'll hear it. Well, if you read Romans 10, it talks about the blessing of taking the word and how beautiful are the feet, even broken, banged up ones like mine, of those that preach the gospel and the good news. So I was thinking of Hudson Taylor, Adoniram Judson, especially this week because of his birthday. Smart kid, born in a pastor's home, learned to read and write Greek and Latin before he started school. Just like many of you, right? By age 16, he enrolled in Brown University. 2.5 years later, at age 19, he graduated valedictorian from Brown University. This guy was brilliant. His mind worked and was wonderful in languages. While he was in college, he turned away from Christ. He turned away from his faith. And then watching his best friend, who was also one who turned away from Christ, die an agonizing death, he realized that there was more to life than just having some strange belief, but that he put his personal faith in Christ. And so he, after graduating, he joined Luther Rice and decided to become Congregational Church. They weren't Baptists. Congregationalists as missionaries to India, where William Carey, the first Baptist missionary from England, was laboring at the time. He married Ann Hazeltine. The next day, he was ordained, and 5 days later, they got on a ship and headed to India. Happy honeymoon to the young couple. But this is what they wanted to do. While they were on the ship, the men met together with their wives for Bible study and prayer, and they became convinced of believer's baptism. And they decided to be baptized by William Carey's ministry there in India when they landed. And of course, that made them a persona non grata to the British East India Company, and they were forced to leave, not even get off the ship and start a ministry there in India. So they went on to Burma and preached and taught, and Luther Rice became so ill he had to leave. Again, I could spend the whole time just talking a sermon about what their life was. He went back to raise support among the Baptists to bring money to that. It took him 5 years to learn the Burmese language and to try and translate portions of the gospel into the language. He preached for 5 years without a single person converted. How many of you would just say, okay, you did it, gave a good shot. A for effort, E for effort, whatever it is, and move on. He stuck it out. His wife miscarried their first child. Their second child, named after Roger Williams, a great preacher, died at age 6 months. It took 12 years, before he had enough people that were saved. There were 18 converts in 12 years that he could formulate a Bible study in a church there. He translated the entire New Testament into Burmese. When the British and the Burmese were in war, well, what does an American sound like? He sounds like a British, right? They threw him in prison for 2 years, hung by his feet by chains on the wall, so that his shoulders and head were on the floor for 2 years. He was finally released from prison, and his third child died, and his wife died in childbirth. And I'm thinking, wow. Another missionary from the States, George Boardman, came with his wife. They said, we won't minister here in the city where you are. We'll go into the jungle area a few miles away. And he contracted malaria and died. His wife, Sarah, married Adoniram Judson as a second wife. And by the way, they had 8 children, 5 of which survived to adulthood. When 10 years later, Sarah's health failed, and she went to sail back home to America, but died on the ship. And so Adoniram Judson sent for a secretary. He said, just send someone over here because they need to write down what's happening in Burma. I've had the privilege this past year of reading 4 different books, including the story by his third wife, the secretary that he hired from the U.S. to come over, who wrote the story, wrote down the lines and the life and the biography of his previous 2 wives. He continued on for 40 years ministering, finally dying at age 61 when he went on doctor's orders out for a short cruise, and he was buried then at sea. His goal was to labor faithfully and start a church and build that church up to 100 members. Did he succeed? In 40 years, he started 100 churches. God greatly used him and accomplished a legacy that, if you don't know the name Adoniram Judson before, you should now, because he is the first missionary that we can look at. And so all of us want that sort of a legacy. I'm not necessarily interested in being chained with my feet up on the wall somewhere and going through all the difficulties that he went through. But we all want a legacy like that, don't we? We want our children to love the Lord, grow up and serve. My son, Jeremiah, is preached last night for the first time in 3 weeks. He had COVID. He's been in the hospital and in bed. And Friday he said, Dad, he said, I put my shoes on for the first time in 3 weeks. But he said, I got to go to church because we're going to have a surprise wedding. Seriously, they did. They had a wedding there during the church service last night in the mission church that they have. And then today they'll be preaching in the main church service. We want that. We want our children. We want our family. We want our legacy to be one that says, okay, we served the Lord. Now, God didn't call me to Burma. We were told this in college and in seminary, not to pray that God wouldn't send us somewhere, because that's probably where God will send us. Say, Lord, anywhere but there. Well, mark it down. That can be where God sends you. So I kept praying, anywhere but Hawaii, Lord, anywhere but Hawaii. I will gladly preach. We're close to Hawaii here in the middle of Wyoming. But we need to maintain our testimony and faithfulness. And that's what Paul is doing here on the final road as he Acts 28 begins. And we're going to look at the first verses of the chapter today and then conclude it, Lord willing, next week. But remember, I said that his journey to Rome is really a fourth missionary journey. Because as you notice on the map that we have, rather than written on the board, we have the map all printed out for you nicely, that he went from Caesarea to Sidon, up into Myra in Lycia, and Cnidus and Crete, and then the shipwreck and all of that. Chapter 28, verse 1 says, after we reached safety, we learned that the island was called Malta. The residents showed us unusual kindness. They kindled a fire, welcomed us, since it had begun to rain and was cold. They were here on the island of Malta. As we looked last week, 50 miles from Sicily, and pretty much the only stopping place. Wonderful port area in the middle of the Mediterranean, but they landed, they didn't even know where they were. They didn't know what it was called. By the way, in Phoenician, it's Melita, which means a beehive, a place where the bees all gathered. Well, that's how the island looked, as people would come there on their ships and dock there and so forth. And a great commissary. But the people were, even though they were barbarians, and by the way, barbarian means that they weren't Greek or Latin speakers. Anybody else with barbarian, don't think of that as a bad term, like it's, you know, something about Attila the Hun or something like that. We're just talking about they weren't civilized like the Roman Empire was. But these were caring, loving, hospitable people, and they were very good here. Well, Paul was gathering, let's read verse 3, gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire. A viper came out because of the heat, fastened on his hand. When the local people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, no doubt this man is a murderer. Though he escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live. However, Paul shook the viper off into the fire and suffered no harm. Here we have Paul, the apostle, the big name, right? Wrote books of the New Testament, doing all this on his fourth missionary journey. Everyone saved because of his guidance in leading them and the Lord's provision. Now they're on shore. He gets bitten. But before that happened, I thought, why is Paul gathering sticks? Isn't that women's work? Okay, I know that sounds kind of sexist, but put yourself back in that time period. The cooking, the fires, things like that was women. It wasn't they were out cutting down trees, because there are no trees on Malta. If you've been there, you recognize that there's some been planted since in certain areas, but it's so they're having to go along where the shipwrecks and the flotsam and the driftwood comes up on the beach, and they're collecting it. And it isn't the women who are out there. It isn't even the prisoners who are on their way to Rome to die. But here's Paul, the guy who just gave them the message of salvation. And he is out there doing it. And I thought to myself, okay, Paul's been through all of this, and now a viper grabs onto him. And it's a seriously poisonous viper. What would I do? Immediately my mind says I would start to whine and complain and scream and act like a fourth grade boy, you know, and go, I'm going to die, this is terrible. Why would God do this to me? Why would this evil happen to me? I'm such a good person. You know, Lord, can't you see I'm serving you? What's with the snake situation? But the people on the island were convinced their God, by the way, justice, Dike, is a Greek god, often called fate. And it's justice has caught up with them. We use that phrase now. Justice catches up with people. Not talking about the God, but the system of justice. But they were just saying, hey, okay. He didn't get away. Thought he could escape death, but here he is. But Paul was protected. Paul was blessed. Paul was doing what God wanted him to do. And nothing could happen to Paul that was not God's perfect will. Did Paul understand it? Talk to him. He's got a snake hanging on his hand. Viper fangs pouring venom into his blood. He doesn't understand why this is happening, but he knows it's God's will. We have a viper hanging on us. This disease going around the world. This civil rioting and unrest and evil that's going on in some of our cities. Destruction and so forth. It's hanging on. And we can say, Lord, why me? What's going on here, Lord? Aren't you in control? Paul just goes, okay. God's in control. And puts it down by the fire and shakes it until it falls off. Folks, we need to have that sort of faith and confidence that what happens is God's leading and working. Now, we can vote. We can do different things to help. But it's still the Lord who is in control. It will all work out according to His will for His glory. And if we knew what God knew, if we knew what God knows, we'd agree with God. Paul didn't whine, he didn't complain. He just shook it off. I like that phrase. He just shook it off. Isn't that what we do? Oh yeah, poisonous snake. By the way, the snake is called a two-stepper in the language. It's a fun little word. I won't teach it to you. But if you look in verse 6, it says they were waiting for him to swell up and suddenly fall down dead. When they'd waited a long time, and he didn't swell up and didn't fall down dead, they changed their mind and said, well, he must be a god, because this is a two-stepper. They call the serpent viper, it's a medical term used today for poisonous snakes, and it's translated two-stepper. In other words, you get bitten by them, you got about two steps, and you're going to fall over dead. And so the island people there are looking, waiting, and nothing happens. The viper bite seemed to have no effect as he shook it off. And can you imagine that then when he told them the gospel, that they might not have listened a little bit more carefully? You go, oh yeah, that's Paul. He's the guy who was bit by the viper, and it didn't hurt him. By the way, didn't the gospel of Mark conclude with that, saying that some after the Lord ascends and we the church, that some will be able to be pick up poisonous snakes and it won't kill them? Now, I'm not advocating we turn into a backwoods Kentucky church here and bring in a bunch of rattlesnakes and do that kind of thing. But it was prophetically written by Mark of Peter's sermon using that illustration that happened to Paul himself. And so they thought he must be a god, and I'm thinking, I'd listen to that guy then. There's something special about him. God's with him in a special way. So that's the miracle. But then what happened? The ministry continued. Paul's on a missionary journey, paid for by the Roman government. It says that in that area of the wreck, there happened to be, I love that, it's just a wonderful word, there happened to be land owned by the leader of the island named Publius, who received us and entertained us, and us is 276 people that came in on the shipwreck. So this is a rich guy. Oh, you guys are all shipwrecked? Come on over to my house for dinner. There's only 276 of them. So this is a rich man. All the area around there, the lands, they didn't know it was still, just learning about Malta, because the capital city and the seaport was about 6 miles to the east on the same side of the island, but this is a whole different island. Anyway, Publius received us, entertained us with hospitality. I might make a difference in the word I use there. Hospitality for 3 days. And it happened that his father was continually sick with fever and dysentery. Paul visited him, prayed, put his hands on him, and healed him. Now, Rome had allowed self-rule to this little island kingdom. They had to pay taxes to Rome, but other than that, they could have their own leadership, of whom Publius is literally the number one man. So he would be the equivalent of like the governor or the king of that island. And it wasn't a chance location that they shipwrecked exactly on his property where he would be able to take care of them. But another special miracle takes place here as he ministers to the dead. The island of Malta has a common illness called Malta fever. And it's from microbes that come in the goat's milk. And there's constant stories over the last 2,000 years of people who lived there and got sick. They run a fever, you run the other end, and you're miserable. You don't die from it, but you wish you were dead. It's one of those type things. And Paul sees him in that symptoms and come on, let me pray for you. And prays, and God miraculously heals. Well, then you can imagine what happened to the rest of the people on the island. Verse 9, when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases kept coming for treatment. I think some translations might have the word healing, but it's literally the word therapeusos, for therapy, a continuous help. The miracle enhanced of the father enhanced the viper story, and people are saying, okay, we'll go there. And Paul became like a medical missionary. He and Luke, who is a doctor, we read in Colossians 4:14, started ministering and giving therapy to these people and helping them as they received medical attention and be able to share the gospel with them. And for months, they continued there in this middle of nowhere island in the middle of the entire Mediterranean Sea. They served God where they were with the ability that they had and the power of God on the word that they preached, on the miracles, on the work that they did. And I thought, well, boy, the lessons we're learning about Paul here just sound like what we need today. We need to be able to learn wherever we are. Not just to be content, like Paul told the Philippians, but wherever we are to minister. Share the gospel. Help with whatever. In a few weeks, we get to start up the sandwich ministry again for the homeless and the poor. I'm looking forward to that. They said, well, you're going to have to wear gloves. And I'm thinking, I hope everybody who makes sandwiches all for the last 10 years wear gloves. Because, you know, that's just good sanitary conditions, you know. But we're excited about that because God's given us an opportunity as a small church here to be able to help people that otherwise we'll never be able to meet. And we can put a little gospel tract and share the plan of salvation, you know, in the bags of the with the water and peanut butter and jelly and all the other stuff that we do for them. And so we need to learn to work and faithfully serve God where He's put us. With what we have, how we can do it. And verse 10 begins with the phrase, and they honored us greatly. There was a good response to the message that was preached. Misery of the, well, more than 2 weeks at sea in the shipwreck time in the storm, God now gave a season of relief and replenishment to the crew, to the captain, to the captives and the soldiers, and to Paul and Luke and those that were with him in this three-month period there that they were on the island there. And God uses us as we use the opportunities to serve Him. You see, this isn't just a travelogue. This isn't Gospel of Luke written, or the Book of Luke written by Luke, the Book of Acts, isn't like a Rick Steves travelogue. You're just saying, oh, we stopped here and here and we did this and such. And, had a wonderful time. By the way, if it was a travelogue, I might not want to go on the same ship. You know, end up treading water in the middle of the Mediterranean somewhere. But God used all of these delays, all of this effort, giving Paul more and more time to proclaim the gospel. My wife and I were talking last night about some end-of-life issues. Do you ever have talks with like that with your family? No, not where your kids say, I wish you'd die. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the end of life where you say, we're going to die. A year and a half ago, I had no idea when I woke up one morning I would have a stroke and end up in intensive care and happy to have, as you know from listening to me, about half a brain working since. But my wife and I were talking, saying, well, now we've got some different things, some decisions, and we probably should make it known and that. We're planning that out. Because, folks, we don't know. Today might be the last day that we have. You have no guarantee of tomorrow. To say, well, tomorrow I'll do this and that, and we'll put aside money, and then we'll take a big trip. You know, how many of you 5 years ago thought, I can hardly wait 5 years from now. I wonder where I'll be. Yeah, well, you'll be in your home, locked up and fearful to go out and breathe and whatever it might be. Paul teaches us to be prepared for these end-of-life decisions long before you get old like me. Teenagers think they're going to live forever and nothing wrong can happen to them. But sadly, we read all the time of car accidents and illness and different things that happen. And so, unexpected delay, and God used it mightily. Finally, we're in verse 10, the second part of verse 10. The expected destination is reached. Verse 10 continues, when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. So after 3 months that they'd been there, we set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, a ship of Alexandria, with twin gods as a figurehead. So they gathered strength, they got supplies, the winter storm season is over. Now they can head back out and get to Rome. And there was a ship that had fortunately wintered there in the island, so they were able to get on it. And details, this is the third ship. Remember, they took a ship out of Caesarea and got up and then transferred to the big ship so they could make it safely. Ended up shipwrecked. Now they're on another big ship from Alexandria heading on up to Rome. But just to remind us that we're dealing with pagans. We're dealing with people who don't believe the Lord. Luke gives us this little odd detail that we entered this ship of Alexandria that had twin gods as figureheads. What do we call the twin gods? Dun, dun, dun,
they're sons of Zeus.
Pardon?
Sons of Zeus.
Sons of Zeus?
They have names.
They do. They have names.
Castor and Pollux?
Pollock I call them, but Pollux. O-X-N. They're the twins. What gods are the twins? You all know the zodiac and all the Gemini, the twins. We still talk about them today. You don't necessarily put it all together. Luke is just, he's trying to say, okay, these are pagan people. They've got, they don't just have one god up in front of their ship. They got two. We're going to make it for sure. We're not going to get caught in another shipwreck. We got two gods in front of our ship. They're worshiping idols. They desperately need the gospel. So I suppose Paul got on the ship and said, okay, well, we're going to cruise on up to Rome from here. I'm just not going to say anything anymore. Now, Luke shares this little tidbit with us just to remind us that the opportunity to witness is there. It's around all the time. The heathen were receptive to them for 3 months on the island, and now the heathen who were running a ship up to Rome or up to Italy there could hear the gospel as well. So the travelogue continues, verse 12. You have it? Putting in at Syracuse, if you think of the island of Sicily, it looks like a football that the boot of Italy is kicking off, and there's a little strait a couple miles across to the mainland of Italy. On the right-hand side of Sicily is the chief city of Syracuse, and it's about 80 miles up from Malta to Syracuse. And they go there, they stop there. Syracuse is one of my favorite stories from ancient history, and you got to forgive me because I'm a historian and I love to bring this into our preaching. When the Romans conquered Sicily, the most famous Sicilian there was a scientist named Archimedes. Have you ever heard of him? Okay, boy, three or four people shook their head. Yes, that either means you're listening or you've actually heard of him. Good, okay. The rest of you are looking like, oh, we had donuts, and the glassy-eyed look is coming across there. But Archimedes was there, and he was trying to teach on the beach, and the Roman soldiers came marching down, and they walked through his area where he was teaching. He was drawing equations in the sand on the beach. And he stood up and told the Roman soldiers, he said, "You're ruining my equation." And the soldier pulled out a sword and killed him. Not a glorious end to a great mathematician, but I thought of things with, I knew math teachers too, that I would think that would be a fitting end to their lives. But never did take a sword to school. So they traveled up here, met with the people in Syracuse, and then there, verse 13, I love the way the King James reads on verse 13. Does somebody have a King James version of the Bible? Sometimes the old English phrasing, do you have it in verse 13? Anybody have it? Or can look it up on your cell phone?
I got one.
You got one. Acts 28:13. No pressure on you, Bruce. We're all just sitting here waiting. I know.
And from thence we fetched a compass and came to Regium.
Okay, that's good enough. That's the language they use. We got there and we fetched a compass. Why did they fetch a compass? They were lost. They needed a compass. No. See, when I read that the first time as a kid, that's what I thought. Okay, they fetched a compass. Well, thank God they got some way to get directions now. What's another kind of compass than the one with the magnet that tells where we're going? Come on, we're back in our math illustration here. Okay, it's the kind you put a pencil in and it draws a circle around, you know, it makes a compass. That's, oh, we fetched a compass. They had to go over and kind of loop around and come around. They couldn't just go straight up there. I know our little map just shows them going on up the side, but they literally did a loop of the island and got up there to Regium on the toe of the boot of the peninsula, the Italian peninsula there. And so they fetched a compass. And now your modern translations would say, we made a circuit and arrived there, or whatever it might be. And after a day, the south wind sprang up. We're shown verse 13. On the second day, we disembark at Puteoli. And so they quickly moved on up, went on up to the Bay of Naples, which is Puteoli, and that's the big harbor area where they could unload the grain, and so that's as far as they got there. They taking this little quick milk run up the side of Italy. Verse 14, at Puteoli we found brethren, and were invited to stay with them for 7 days. So the sea voyage is over. And now the last 40 miles will be on the well-paved Appian Way. You can still walk it today. I don't know if any of you have been to Rome in that area. It's a beautiful, wide, It's made of stone, so it's a little bit bumpy as you walk, I can guarantee that. But you can walk right on the Romans Road, the Appian Way. And it was went from the big harbor on up to Rome itself. Ship unloaded its cargo and passengers. Prisoners were marched to Rome for their execution. And the early Christians here met with Paul. They said, look, at Paul is here. And they had sweet fellowship. And they you know, there were existing congregations in Italy. It isn't like Paul's going there for, it's his first trip, but there's been Christians there for decades. And they get to meet with Paul. What a blessing. In verse 14 concludes with almost a letdown. After all the book of Acts, it says, and so we arrived in Rome. I would say, that starts a new chapter. We're going to be in Rome. This is it. But it's just, okay, we finally made it. Because in the plan of God, it wasn't a new chapter. It wasn't a new great special thing. It was simply God moving you from one place to the next, to the next. One job, one school, one group of friends and co-workers, and moving on and on and on with life. And it's up to us what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to be a testimony and a witness there. And so they arrived in Rome. They're still 30-some miles out of Rome, but this is where the boundary of the city would be. That this is now we're in the environment, in the greater metropolitan area of Rome. Verse 14 continues, we arrived at Rome, and the brethren there, when they heard about us, came as far as the market of Appius and the Three Inns to meet us. And on seeing them, Paul thanked God and was encouraged. It was the practice of the Romans, if you had company coming, if you had special dignitaries coming, if you had Caesar returning from a military campaign, when he landed in the harbor at Naples, got on the Appian Way, they would come out to the edge of the city metropolitan area, well-known places called the market or the forum of Appius, the three taverns or inns. They would come out and meet them. It's a tradition to greet the emperors and walk with them back into town and make a big parade and celebration. That's what the Christians did for Paul. Isn't that what we do to our missionaries when they come back from the foreign field, when they've been ministering and working and sacrificing? No, usually they come back broken in health, aged. And we say, well, I hope they put some money aside so that they don't have to live on Social Security the rest of their life. It's a very sad thing. Our church in Dallas, where I was for a number of years, owned six houses that people had died and bequeathed to the church as a gift, you know, for their in their will. And so when missionaries would come to speak at the church and that, they could stay in one of those houses for free. When missionaries would come home from a foreign field, our church would say, okay, you can spend 6 months in a house and do nothing. Come to church services, but do nothing. Recover, recuperate, do like Paul did on Malta there for months. Get your health back. And then you can live there another 6 months, but go out to other churches and give your testimonies of what God did and raise more support money, and then head back to the field. By the time we left that church, we had 16 houses like that. Because as people died, they left more houses saying, let God use them. And so our church was able to take missionaries who had served 50 years in the Congo, Zaire, that region of Central Africa. 50 years. And they were able to come back, be honored in a church service, given the keys to a brand new car. Sadly, it was from one of our lady Sunday school teachers, Mary Kay. Do you all know the Mary Kay cosmetic lady? So what kind of car was it?
Yeah.
A pink Cadillac, yeah. And they give her a key to a car to year, use for a year, and then given the keys to a house that as long as they live, they would have a place of honor, they would have a place to stay. And I can remember my wife and I and the kids gathered together groceries to have a food shower to help people that had come in. It's exciting time. That's the way missionaries should be. It's like the missionaries who served in Africa and came home in 1907. And they came into New York City. And on the dock was a band playing. Banners, welcome home. Throngs of crowds, thousands and thousands of people. Da-da-da-da-da. They didn't realize that on their ship was Teddy Roosevelt, who was coming home from a safari in Africa. He got off the ship. The bands led the parade. The crowds all followed. And this elderly veteran missionary couple looked at each other and said, "Where's the welcome? Where's the crowds? Where's the people thankful that what we did serving the Lord?" And her husband looked at her and said, "We're not home yet. There'll be a welcome like that." But I thought, no wonder Paul was encouraged. No wonder, honored by meeting these people. And you know, Paul was human. He put his toga on one arm at a time. You know, he was just like you or me. And he is happy and serving God. And now these people come up and he's saying, "Okay, I'm not forgotten. They read my letter," written in 57 AD to the Romans. We call it the Book of Romans in our Bible. And these people felt like they already knew Paul. None of them had met Paul. But for 30 miles back into the city, they got to walk with him and encourage him and be a blessing to him. And verse 16 concludes the text for today's sermon. "When we entered Rome," we being Luke with him, "Paul was allowed to stay by himself with only a soldier who guarded him. God promised that he would be safe. He would come to Rome. He would be able to speak with Caesar. And even before then, they say, okay, you can rent a house. You can stay here. You're not under death sentence. You're not a prisoner. But you have to be guarded because you're making your appeal, your court case to Caesar. But Rome now in the center of the world, the civilized world, Rome which had, by the way, if you think of Rome as a big city, it had 50,000 middle and upper class, merchant, rich people, 50,000 people. It had 1 million lower class. They would be the day laborers, the workers, the ditch diggers, the servants, or whatever it might be, the military. And there were 1 million slaves. And by the way, they were almost all white, because the word slave is from Slav, the Slavic countries. They conquered Hungary and what we would think of as Romania and Czechoslovakia and Poland, and made them the slaves. That's what Rome looked like. Center of the world, but only a handful that were free and wealthy. Paul walked in there. He's got his ministry in front of him. The Colosseum in Rome hadn't been built yet. It was built well after Paul's death in the Book of Acts closing. But he was there ministering to all these people, given the limited freedom so that he might be able to share the gospel with the rich and famous, with the soldiers and the poor and non-famous, like Julius, his guard, had been, and with the million slaves that were there. We'll even read about one of them later on, who had escaped, a slave that had escaped from Colossae, the city over in Asia, and had come to Rome, and Paul led him to Jesus there. And so he was captive. Yeah, he was under house arrest, but he looked at the city of Rome as a captive audience. He would have the chance where God had put him now to minister. Folks, that's the spirit we have to have. did all of this disease and quarantines and schools not working right and jobs closing off, is all of this taking God by surprise? Did you ever stop to think God didn't have to ever stop and think? He always knew it. It's all in the plan. And so when we see ourselves saying, we say, well, Lord, what are you doing? The better question is to say, Lord, I don't know what you're doing, but I trust you. Let me do what I now can do to minister. As he came here, and we're not going to read anything about Paul and his trial, how he spoke to Caesar's household, how he talked to the church in Rome. Even the end of this chapter just deals with him with Jewish people there. But God is laying out lessons that we can learn, short, hopefully, of a shipwreck, that we can learn to just be faithful and trust God and serve God every day. That's what he wants us to do. That's why it's written. That's why it's our example. So we have the example of Adoniram Judson from history a few hundred years ago, changing the world with foreign missions. From 2,000 years ago from Paul. And what is the church going to say about you 200 years from now or 2,000 years from now? Remember, we might be only in the early church days. This could be the early church. And it might be thousands more years. Unless you listen to the news, and then you worry if it's going to be tomorrow, you know, what might happen. But what are they going to say? What's required of a servant of the Lord? One thing. Moreover, it's required in servants that they be found faithful. That's all. Maybe the brass band will be there, the accolades of others. Maybe it won't. But we're not home yet.